Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Sunday, March 18th, 2018. And what a week it has been here in Nashville. We woke up Monday morning with snow on the ground and finished Saturday with 75 degrees and sunny. Spring is becoming evident around the garden. I've got onions in, lettuce is coming up, and we have some bluebirds making nesting gestures at our bluebird boxes. Well, today's podcast deserves a little bit of a personal story by way of introduction. I grew up pretty much a city kid in Cincinnati. That being said, I probably had better than normal exposure to the natural world. Cincinnati does have wonderful parks, and it does have nature study programs for children. Boy Scouts took me out camping. I had a father who was a hunter and a mother who was a gardener. That being said, I only began to learn that everything we see in that is green on the landscape was not necessarily good when I moved to Tennessee in 1975. There, for the first time, I witnessed kudzu. The stuff seemed to be everywhere. The city manager of the city of Gatlinburg at the time, where I was working, had initiated a program of kudzu eradication within the city limits. For that time, this was a remarkably innovative program, particularly important in an area adjacent to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. When I came to Nashville and began to work with the state of Tennessee, I had the privilege of working alongside botanist Dr. Paul Summers and Linda Dries, who was the state park's natural resources management expert. Both of these individuals opened my eyes to what was really going on the landscape. This was when I started learning about exotic plants like bush honeysuckle and Chinese privet and the devastating effect they were having on our natural landscape, native vegetation, and wildlife. More recently, the book Bringing Nature Home by Doug Talamay brought into focus just how important what we do in our own backyards can be. And so I sat down on Friday afternoon with my friend Mike Berkeley. Mike and his wife Terry Barnes are the proprietors of Grow Wild Nursery in Fairview, Tennessee. Mike is truly one of America's foremost experts in the field of native plants. Mike serves on the board of the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council, and he agreed to sit down with me and discuss the most common invasive plants that we see occurring in our neighborhoods and their native alternatives. I encourage my listeners to check out the website of the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council. The website contains a great deal of important information about invasive plants and their alternatives. You can find the list of plants that are considered to be invasive in Tennessee, along with several PowerPoint presentations, which are freely available. And so I hope you'll enjoy this afternoon's program with Mike Berkeley. Mike Berkeley, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hey, Mark. Old friend.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
We've known each other a long time, I guess.
I have been looking forward to this so much.
Yeah.
Mike, you and I have known each other probably 20 years or more. And I know you fairly well, but my listeners probably don't. Some of them may, but tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into what you're doing.
Well, I guess foremost, I am a co-owner of Grow Wild Incorporated, a native plant nursery in Fairview, Tennessee. And then as far as we can tell right now, we are the largest native plant nursery in the whole Mid-South area. And we've got somewhere around 1,000 different species and cultivars of North American natives. Endangered, some federally protected endangered species, but we just love growing the natives. We've got 30 different species of oaks.
Mike, did you grow up at a farm, or what? Where did you grow up? Or what?
No, I grew up in West Nashville in suburbia.
Okay,
and I would bet you that some of your listeners probably would remember me back in West Nashville, I came from a single parent home. My father was not there. My mother insisted on my brother and I to do all the boy things that we were meant to do. So she got me out in the woods as a single mother and showed me things. She didn't know the names of these plants, but showed me plants, showed me, I can remember far back camping at Pickett State Park up on the Cumberland Plateau and seeing things up there that I didn't see back home in West Nashville. And so she insisted in getting us out into the woods, and then I got into Boy Scouts, and I think that was
Boy Scouts. Exactly.
That's it. And I think at that time there was started an appreciation. I still didn't know what these things were, but I think there was a respect, I guess is the word, respect of all things natural out there. And then I worked in I worked in a garden center it was more and more garden center.
Okay.
And Paul Moore was there. And I met Paul, a good friend of mine still today. And
Paul. The moss man.
Oh, man. I mean, so many jokes we have about Paul and his mosses. But he was the first one I met at a retail level that said, okay, we're going to start selling more natives. Because, oh gosh, you know, 80, 90% of what we saw in the garden centers then were not native species, indigenous species. So it was a pretty gutsy move at the time. And I said, oh, well, count me in. And so he kind of hired me in as a help him out as, in finding these plants. And Mark, we had to look at into Nebraska. There was a couple of nurseries up north in the Midwest. There was nobody down here in the Mid-South, especially in the state of Tennessee at the time, that really specialized in native plants in some kind of volume. So I said, okay, well, there's my chance. I knew this whole time in all my years, and of course I'm open in age now, and I'm thinking, okay, this is where I'm supposed to go.
And so, Mike, did you go to school and train in horticulture?
Well, I went back to school at Middle Tennessee State University and met some great professors there, took plant soil science. Kurt Bloom there, B-L-U-E-M, by the way, which I think is great that he has a last name Bloom for in
exactly.
Talks about
exactly.
Flowering plants. But Dr. Hemmerly, Larry Sizemore, all these guys were, you know, they were my mentors. And what was really great was that the universities at the time didn't say, well, we're specializing in landscaping with native plants. So you would either have a botany side of it, and you would learn everything through keying out plants, no understanding species and plant communities. And then there was the horticultural side of it, and that is, well, not necessarily natives, but all things that you could, that are ornamentals and turf grass and woodies and things that you could put in a typical suburbia or commercial applications. What I wanted to do was put those two together,
right,
and have landscaping with native plants, you know, is because it's not just growing the native plants and understanding native plants, but we want to put them back where they used to be. And where they used to be is right in suburbia, or it's at the bank office building, your parking lot, you know, and even on the green roofs, you know, I do these green roofs, all native green roofs. Well, that's still, maybe it's 9 stories up, but it's still where they used to be. So the idea is just you have to have landscaping with native plants because you want to install those back in, put those back in.
Exactly.
And in many cases, you've got to put those in not necessarily favorable conditions as they used to be. You know, we're talking turf grass, and turf grass is not necessarily a native plant community.
And right.
So the mycorrhiza fungi, all the living organisms that were once there when it was a healthy hardwood forest, they're not there anymore. So you've got to cheat a little bit to get some of those especially the woodland wildflowers and the ferns, you know. So
now, Mike, you're here today with us because I posed a question of the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council and asked them to arrange to have a speaker for me. and you drew the short straw, apparently.
Yeah.
And so tell us about that organization and what it's all about. Just so make sure that we do them justice a little bit.
Well, yeah, and it's a great, you know, I could nonprofit myself to death and be all over the world in all these different groups and councils. And I love these guys because they really are, you know, dear to my heart. In fact, we're really there to bring awareness to the public, whether it's a homeowner or a government level, but to bring awareness about the risk of these invasive non-native species and what they're doing to our natural areas. Okay. They started back in 1994. It was in March of 1994, and the idea was to kind of copy what some other states had done. Well, up until that point, it was only Florida and California that had done it. So really, you could say we were on the cutting edge as well in the state of Tennessee, and we were, you know, the third in the nation to do this.
My understanding is the original group were mainly federal and state government, maybe one or two local government people that manage large tracts of land.
That's true.
And we're dealing with with kudzu and some of these major invasive problems.
Right. And you know, that was, you know, and I think that was, there was a turning point there where we said, okay, it's not just the natural areas, it's all the lands.
Right. Right.
And that means, okay, as urban sprawl happens, you know, right here around Nashville, you see that, as urban sprawl happens, we start taking and developing some of these natural areas, or, you know, that were natural areas, and we want to do the right thing and ethically put the right thing back in. And so knowing, you know, letting people know that there are some not good plants out there. And you know, Mark, let me say right now that I'll be the first to say, even as much as I love my natives, that not every non-native species is a bad boy.
Exactly.
And, you know, crepe myrtle is yet to be found escaping. You can go all over Savannah, Georgia. You can go down in the deep south and look at the crepe myrtle.
It stays where it's put.
It stays where it's put.
Right.
And it's from China. So, you know, not every non-native plant is an invasive. But once it starts invading and competing with those natural areas and those native plant communities, and in many cases, out competing some endangered species that are out there.
Now, Mike, I've got this organization that you're working with, that you're on the board of, has published a list of species of plants that they consider to be threatening to the natural environment in the state. And then they have some that are on the list that they're just watching to see. But I want to go through that list with you here in a moment. Let's talk about some of those that we might see, you know, in a typical suburban landscape. Before we do that, though, I want to say that it's sort of, a nice coincidence, that just last week we had the weed wrangles going on in our Tennessee State Parks. Tell us about what those were.
I'll tell you what, Mark, this is exciting. And the fact that Nashville is ground zero, this is the beginning of the weed wrangle. And this year, the weed wrangle has jumped up to the mid-Atlantic. It's in Texas. And for the first time, it's up in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest. And it all started here in Nashville. So the idea is that, okay, we want to make all people aware, especially the private sector, of how important it is to know what these non-native invasive species are. So the Garden Club of America, the National Chapter of Garden Club of Nashville, the story goes, and Casey McAllister can tell you all about it. I think she would be great to be on this show. She had the president of the National Garden Clubs of America come in, and in a nutshell, she said, asked Casey, so, well, if you had a project that this chapter was going to take on, this garden club was going to take on, what would it be? And she started seeing all this bush honeysuckle and privet, things that she was not used to seeing because she's from another area of the United States that didn't have these invasive non-native species. And Casey said pretty much, you know, well, I guess this will be it. And then Casey has a relative, a young relative, that came up with this idea of calling it the weed wrangle.
I love the idea.
And it's marketed now, and you'll see that little registration.
I saw the
trademark
registration.
Yeah, and it's been great. And it's all happens every year around the last few days of the National Weed Awareness Week. Okay. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, the government says, okay, well, let's recognize the fact that we do have some problems with this. And so that's the National Weed Awareness Week. And then the weed wrangle will happen on that in that week.
So, for instance, Radnor Lake and Cedars of Lebanon State Parks, and I noticed Montgomery Bell had a, they had a place where an opportunity for people to come and participate in a weed eradication.
That's right. It's all volunteer. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the great things come out of it, and I just love the idea of marketing the invasive non-native species. In other words, we're not promoting them.
Right.
We're just making people aware of
awareness.
So the first one we had a few years ago, I attended, and I was with Steve Manning with Invasive Plant Control, and a lot, so several people, Casey McAllister was there at the National Zoo. And Mark, there was, gosh, it had to be 100 plus kids out there, from high school, elementary, middle school, some college students there on that one day pulling privet, which is highly invasive. You know about the privet, highly invasive, out of, you know, this creek area. And these kids, they didn't know what that plant was, and, you know.
They know it now.
They know it now, and at the end of the day. So we're thinking, okay, well, what does that mean? Well, they went home and went to their parents and said, Mom and Dad, let me tell you what I did today. Oh, and by the way, you know what you've got in your backyard? In our backyard, we have privet.
Right.
So there's this awareness. It's that marketing of the native, the non-native species and the invasives. And so I just love it. The wheat rain was just snowballing. As several people have said, it's got legs of its own now. And we're looking going national with this.
Yeah, and I encourage my listeners to just Google Tennessee weed wrangle. And you will, the Tennessee State Park site will come up, the State Natural Area site will come up, the Garden Club site will come up, and you will see what's going on. And, you know, their weed eradication programs are not limited to just this one event. They have things going on all year and opportunities for volunteers to participate.
Yeah, and that's what makes this so successful is the volunteer group.
Right.
You know, without the volunteers and, you know, and even if you don't know what these plants are, you know, just having someone there that can pull, you, when you see thousands of little 1-inch, 2-inch tall privet, and you can make a big impact on that, because if they grow up to maturity and produce seed, there you go.
Exactly. They become the birds eat them, and then they spread them everywhere.
So, you know, typically what it is, it's on in morning from 9 to 12. And some groups will go a little bit further. And in some groups, this the past couple of events, there's also planting native trees as they are removing the invasive non-native species.
Fun. Well, if it's appropriate to have a weed wrangle in the state park, it's certainly appropriate to have a weed wrangle in your backyard.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
Okay. Absolutely.
Let's just, Mike, I'm going to get this list, which is the list for anybody to see. If you go to the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council website, you can see this list. It's not a mystery. And I know some of these trees. I don't know all of them. Tree of Heaven, of course, is the major problem, but you don't see that much in neighborhoods.
Well, not in neighborhoods, but you'll see it right outside of the neighborhoods. And the big thing about the ailanthus, the Tree of Heaven, is, and what a terrible common name for that, because
it's a stinky thing.
I don't think it's from, it smells, I don't know of too many plants. If you take and scratch the bark and smell it, or twig and smell it, there's nothing else. I'd say skunky is the best way to put it. So, but the what we see on the Tree of Heaven is that it can grow a lot in a lot of places that a lot of other woodies, whether it's native or non-native, can't. And so when you see a rock outcrop of a road cut or a railroad cut, you know, and you think, okay, well, nothing's going to grow on that, Tree of Heaven can.
They'll come up through the crack in the sidewalk.
Yeah, that was the tree that grew in Brooklyn.
Exactly.
It was the Tree of Heaven.
So if you see this in your yard, it needs to be removed. No
right. And you know, of course, we want to make sure we are IDing these species, you know, because it's a very close look-alike to a lot of our native sumacs that we have.
Exactly.
And of course, the sumac will have, in the fall, early winter, will have those dark red fruiting bodies. But the leaf on a sumac, a native sumac, and the leaf on a tree of heaven are almost identical. So,
except for the smell.
The smell. And that's the key, is that when you think you've got this figured out, just make sure. Go up there and scratch the bark and take a smell.
The leaf almost looks like a walnut leaf because it's almost. Component leaf. You're going to use the botanical term.
The compound leaf.
Compound leaf. Exactly. make sure you get that you're identifying it properly.
Right,
but
right.
These things produce seed like wild.
And I think, Mark, what we see, it produces seed and it colonizes. And you will actually go into a grove of those in some natural areas. And what I want to say is that about this is that, no, you don't see them really in urban suburbia so much, you know. But as we, again, start building out from Nashville, okay, we start to see it. And it was already established. Maybe there was an old homestead there. And they saw, okay, Tree of Heaven, this is something I want to have in my yard. And, you know, 50 years later, it's taken over this wooded area. So the idea is that, okay, you have an opportunity at that time when you're building that new house on the 20, 30 acres, do something about it then,
right.
Okay? And then, of course, put the native species back in where that used to be.
One of the things that we do see quite often in and around driving around Nashville, and listeners will be familiar with the mimosa tree.
Yeah. And now I'll tell you, Mark, that broke my heart because, you know, think about it.
It broke your heart.
Well, these, you know, we were born and raised with a lot of these trees.
Exactly.
Right? You
exactly.
know, when I was a kid, I climbed, my favorite tree in our yard in West Nashville was a mimosa. And those powder puff pink blooms.
Smelled beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. It was just a great tree and that oriental look that it had, you know. And then we find out that it was invasive. And then it's out competing, and it's very aggressive. And many times in the late spring, early summer, you're driving down the interstate, just look at that pink hue going down through the interstates of this tree that was not there one time.
Right. And it came from Southeast Asia.
It's a Japanese species. So, you know, this is where, you know, I say, oh boy, I hate that. But hey, we've got to do something about it. So I think what's happening now, like in the native plant movement, is that what can the native plant growers produce that would be the mimosa look-alike?
What would that be?
Well, a lot of the new red buds coming on are going to be that, okay, as they have the same shape. You know, and then the other thing we got to think about is that, you know, we're not just putting these plants out there just for us and our eye candy. You know, there's that habitat food source. You know, when we start doing things that are plants that are not originally from here, it affects the whole food chain. And so pollinators, you can talk about pollinators right now and have several shows about, you know, the risk of the pollinators. You know, what is a mimosa? What does that really do for our pollinators? It's not much of anything. You can have a hawthorn out there that has great nectar and pollen source. You can have the red buds that have great nectar sources. And of course, in a lot of your native wildflowers, the asters, the coneflowers. So, you know, you can do that. This non-native tree, the mimosa, is strictly there as it's an ornamental.
Right. You know, I tell this story too often, but we had a mimosa tree in our backyard when we moved into this house in 1983. And I cut it down. And I think last year was the first year that I had not seen babies of that tree, because the seeds lay dormant in the soil for 10 years
sure.
or more.
Sure.
And if a little disturbance of the soil, and up it will come. So the mimosa is one that everyone will be familiar with and needs to be taken a sharp look at.
Right, and there's a discussion also, Mark, about, you know, cultivars of some of these trees, you know, some of these plants, and there's a chocolate mimosa out there that's really hot. And
I hadn't heard of that.
Oh, yeah, and it's got a dark red leaf, and I'm just cautioning everybody that they may say that it's a sterile variety, a sterile cultivar. Caution, you know, is that it's still the species, and if it fruits, then there you go. You got those straight mimosas.
Well, they said that same thing about the Bradford pear. I was going there. Okay.
Yeah, and here we are in the middle of March. And what is the predominant tree blooming out there right now? The Pyrus calorieta, the Bradford pear. Who knew? I sold that in the retail garden center at one time. I sold Bradford pears. Mark, it was the greatest thing since the wheel. A perfect, fast-growing tree that kept that symmetry, had an early bloom, great fall color, and then, it produced these small little, or wasn't supposed to produce small little fruit, and now it does, and the birds took them. And now, it has invaded some natural areas, and if you see white off into the woods right now, and that's the other thing about some of these non-native invasives, is that they bloom and flush out at a different
time. The earliest time.
Right. The Bradford pears are just, and so now, they've lost favor, sure, okay? And people are saying, well, I don't want, And I think that's been really encouraging is that a lot of homeowners now are saying, gosh, I used to love this tree. Now I don't like this tree. I'm cutting it down. Right. And they're saying, okay, let's put something in its place. So there is that awareness, okay? And
when you cut down the Bradford pear, unless it's a dead tree, you need to treat the stump.
You got to treat the stump, and that's, or have the stump removed.
Let's talk about what the Bradford pear is. It's really, as you use the Latin term, it's a
Pyrus calorieta.
It is a Chinese.
It's an Asian species, right?
That was collected by somebody from the USDA.
Right, and this guy, he produced a beautiful ornamental tree. That was non-fruiting. It was sterile, okay? Well, it crossed, as soon as that bloom happened, it crossed with all those fruit-producing pears. And we love our pears, our fruit pears. And it crossed with that, and the next thing you know, this sterile species, this sterile variety, became thick with it. And now stone fruit is something we don't want.
If you go to the store and buy a Bradford pear, you're buying rootstock that is the straight species of the calorie pear,
right,
that's been grafted with a clone of that original Bradford.
Supposedly.
Well,
and there's other, and we call it Bradford pear, has been kind of a catch-all, Mark. I mean, we call it Bradford pear, but there's actually, that's why a lot of times I'll say Pyrus aristocrat, capital. And so there's other varieties, and I hear all the arguments of saying, well, some of these other varieties that are not the Bradford pear are, maybe they're more sterile. It's still Pyrus calorieta.
If you cut that down at the root, what comes up is straight species
Pyrus calorieta
with thorns.
And will reproduce.
So when you do cut it down, it's important that it be
treated. Within 20 minutes, if you can put the glyphosate on that tree, kill it out.
And there are zillions of alternatives to that tree. If you want a nice flowering fruit tree.
Serviceberry. So here we're talking about, what is it that promotes the native plant replacements for those beautiful non-native ornamental trees that have escaped. You start talking birds, edible, we can eat them, we like them. The whole sustainability idea, and they're beautiful trees. So serviceberries are really coming on now, and they're the new Bradford pear look-alike. They're not as weak-wooded, and that's one of the other complaints about the Bradford pear is that
the heavy wind,
ice storm that we get here, they're going to go down. And then also, there's no fragrance, which is a good thing, no fragrance to the serviceberry.
Right, the Bradford pear
smells. I don't like it. It's not pleasant. So there's the replacements. And then some of these red buds that we're talking about, there's new varieties that actually can bloom white. So the idea is, again, is to find those replacements that are more sustainable in the native. And if it's not a native plant, as long as it's not an invasive non-native
plant. And Mike, as I drive around Nashville, especially at this time of the year, and what you said earlier about the exotics, I use that term, the trees that are not native to this neck of the woods, they're the first things to green up and bloom out.
Right.
But during the wintertime, when things are not green, what's green on the landscape is the winter creeper and the English ivy that's out there in the in these huge trees. And you drive down Sharondale or any of these streets in West Nashville, and you'll see these huge trees
covered with green,
mm-hmm. almost to choke the tree.
Right.
It will choke the tree eventually.
Yes.
And it's winter creeper and English ivy. Tell us about those things.
Well, you know, it's funny thing is that, you know, back in the horticulture days, you know, without those two, you wanted to cover a brick wall, you put English ivy up. You wanted to have an evergreen ground cover that you didn't have to water feed or anything. In a commercial site, in an island, in a parking lot, well, it was the Euonymus coloratus, the winter creeper. And you know, so now we're finding those, not only are they escaping out into the natural areas, they're killing trees in people's yards.
Right.
English ivy, go figure, you know, and I, you know, all you need to know, if you want to know where we could possibly be headed here now, drive the corridor between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, and you'll see nothing but English ivy in those trees. And how many trees have they lost because this English ivy has just brought down? So the idea there is that as soon as you can do it, cut those at the base, careful not to nick the tree that it's on, and get that to kill out. And then, yes, you can paint that cut in like we're talking about doing the craft repair. But this is a very critical thing because we're watching trees come down. Massive oaks that we thought was not going to disappear are coming down because of the English ivy.
I mean, it's almost a rule of thumb. If you see vines, that green vine growing on a tree in Nashville, it's not supposed
to be there. Chances are it's not native.
Chances are it's not native. The only vines that you would see native would be some of the grape vines. And
crossvine.
Crossvine and some poison ivy. Of course.
Yeah.
That stuff is bad.
Yeah. But you know, it's still many of these. I think the big concern now is that they're still available.
You can still buy them in the store.
Still buy them, and I think that's where you know I've always said since I've been in this business, don't anytime underestimate the power of the buying gardener. I mean, look at the millions, millions, and millions of dollars that we spend in spring and summer in garden centers.
Mike, it's worse than that. let me just tell you, because we still have landscape architects and landscape designers, I'm using air quotes here, speccing those things in, and we still have the city government who has an opportunity to review the plans, saying that's okay.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I see the turnaround happening. I wish it was faster,
yeah,
but I see it's happening. I've been hired as a consultant with National Metro to work with their new landscape architect, which I've known he worked with the federal government with the National Park System. And working with him now to give guidance so that, you know, they can rewrite the books, the regulations, and say, okay, there are some plants outlawed. And that's the word.
Right.
It's just you cannot use those anymore.
Right.
Now, just because they're still available doesn't mean we have to use them.
Right.
And I think, again, is that, you know, we can say this at the government level, but the backyard gardener, the suburban gardener that goes to that garden box store, garden center, has all she can walk in there and say, you're selling an invasive non-native. You got English ivy on the shelf. Do you know how bad that is? And then here's the caveat, you know, is what they'll say. I'm not coming back in here anymore. Well, that happens a few hundred times.
Exactly.
And the next thing you know, the buyer for that chain store make some changes, and
exactly.
They could. So I still say that I see the turnaround happening, and really it is from the suburbia. That gardener is making some changes, Mark, and I think it's really great to see that, is that we get at our nursery, new people come in all the time and say, I want to do the right thing. And they're removing privet, and they're removing bush honeysuckle, and they're removing Bradford pear, and they're saying, okay, I want to do this, I want to do the right thing. And for every reason, you know, pollinators, the birds, wildlife, you know, whatever the reason, they're making those changes, you know. So
let's talk just a second about those that you just mentioned. Bush honeysuckle, and there are kinds of that, as I'm
right, and some are not as bad as others. Right. I mean, there's and there's actually native bush honeysuckle, and that's the problem with the common name is, you know, we call honeysuckle a lot of Cera as a genus, but there are native, what we call bush honeysuckles, and they're not Lonoceras or they're Darvilles, but you know, when you go to a garden center and ask for honeysuckle, you got to be clear with that, because there's coral honeysuckle, which is the vine that's great for hummingbirds. It's
native, which is a native.
Native,
yes.
And then there is bush honeysuckle, okay? Now, bush honeysuckle that we know has been all from Radnor Lake to Warner Park, all around Nashville, that is on a stop, grow, stop, sell list.
What does that mean?
Okay, the State Department of Agriculture came up with a list, and this is where the TNPC, the Invasive Plant Council, came in, is that, you know, to kind of, what plants can we put on there that can be under state regulation and say they are outlawed in the state of Tennessee? Okay. And mimosa almost got onto that list,
sure.
But it's not. It's not on that list, so it's still able to be sold. So all these plants, and there are some of these that are not necessarily ornamental species, but they are not to be grown in the state of Tennessee by a commercial nursery, and they're not to be sold in the state of Tennessee. And each state has its list, its noxious.
Yeah, the bush honeysuckle.
Right, bush honeysuckle is on that list. So you're not going to see it at a garden center sold.
Right.
You'll see, sure, Pyrus calariata, Bradford pear. You'll see burning bush, which is starting to escape.
Another one now.
Another one, you know. But, and mimosa. But you're not going to see the bush honeysuckle. Well, we already are established with it. And, I mean, you go to any natural green space around Nashville, and the chances are there's going to be bush honeysuckle or privet or both.
You know, they've had such success at Radnor in eradicating the bush honeysuckle.
Yeah,
it's not gone by any means, but
what an impact they've made there.
You know, and the impact from a positive standpoint of what they've done is we now are seeing whole hillsides of native ephemeral wildflowers.
Right.
That we never saw before.
Well, one of the things we didn't know about this bush honeysuckle is that it's got what we call allopathic root system, okay? So it actually, in common terms, it exudes a toxicity that acts like a pre-emergent herbicide. So when wildflowers try to reseed themselves, a bird may bring in some seed of a native species, and it doesn't germinate. So that's why you see monoculture in the bush honeysuckle, like at some of our local parks, is that nothing else will grow on there. So how, you know, that's one of the things we take great pride in here in the state of Tennessee, especially in Middle Tennessee, is the diversity of our flora. You know, a lot of different species. In the state of Tennessee, there's 24 species of oaks, okay? I mean, we can really be proud of that and say we're very diverse. So when you see monoculture like that, when you see nothing but one species, put up a flag and say, wait a minute.
Something's wrong here.
There's something wrong.
Right. So if a homeowner wants to remove a privet or a honeysuckle bush, best method is just dig it out.
Dig it out, pull it up. You know, that's one of the things we learned at Weed Wrangle is that pulling, the power of pulling. And, there's these weed pullers that we actually will use, metal bars that just works as a pivot, and you can pull these up by the root. That's the
kind of a big lever.
The big lever,
yeah,
right. And you can pull those up, put a little pressure to them, you can pull them up, and that's the best way. And, you know, it starts simple. Start easy, you know, with it. See those seedlings that are down there? Piece of cake. Pull those up. Get that. When you see a privet start flowering, at least cut the flowers off so that it doesn't go to seed. Because if we can keep the birds from taking those little black olive looking fruit everywhere, you know, so, and then, yeah, ultimately do away. But also with caution, when you take everything out, and in some people's yards I've seen around Nashville, if they removed every invasive non-native species, they wouldn't have a plant left. True. You know, so pick your battles, be strategic, prioritize this, do a little section at a time, put some native plants back in there, do another section at a time, you know, okay? And then also, don't be so naive to think that they won't come back.
Yeah, I was going to say monitor is the next step.
There's a lot of seed. You mentioned that earlier, that, you know, sometimes these seed can sit for a long time in the soil.
Well, and your neighbors, if just to give, knowing you were coming to my yard today, Mike, and you were going to do a tour of my yard, I went around with Beth, and we spotted two or three little baby privet hedges, and
I was going to say, Mark, you've got a really clean yard.
Well, they, you know, if your neighbors are growing them,
right,
they will come up in your yard,
right.
So monitor, and when you pull up the seed, thankfully the privet seed will only last a year or two in the soil. Same with the burning bush and some of those. They don't have the seeds don't last.
Well, but they do produce a lot of seed. And here's one of the birders will be the first to tell you is that we really have a genuine concern now about our migratory birds because of this one plant has been a big one. It's in the olive family, and that's why I want to say
which is that? The burning
bush?
The
privet, yeah. And so it produces those clusters of those blue-black berries, you know, tiny little berries. And sure, you'll see birds all over them in the fall, okay?
Right.
Well, you know, they're eating. It's fast food. And they're eating it because they can't get enough nutrient value out of it. So what happens, it weights them down, so that it affects their migratory path south. So we're seeing that, okay, it's all connected. We see it now, it's all connected. You know, if they eat that many berries and it's affecting the flight path, okay, there's another reason to take that out.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm not going to take it out because it's invasive. Oh, but now I love my birds. And now there's another reason to get that.
You know, and it's funny that you mentioned that because there's been a dust up recently on Facebook about the cedar waxwings and their consumption of the Nandina berries.
There was a large kill down in North Georgia. And when this hit the news, everybody go, oh, here we go. And you know, Nandinas, that's a very popular suburban residential.
It's pretty. Yeah.
And you know, and we love those, we call it heavenly bamboo. Because it had that bamboo-like stalk to it, had pretty yellow-white flowers. The fall color was amazing, but clusters of these red berries that were beautiful were up around Christmas time. So how can you beat that? You know, so down in North Georgia, the Nandina is highly invasive. It has just taken over large areas. So cedar waxwings came in and said, "Oh, red berries in winter. Here we go." And there was a large bird kill. So there was an autopsy, several autopsies done, and that's what they found was all the Nandina berries.
They have some sort of arsenic or something in the berries.
There's a toxicity in the berry.
Right.
And in concentration like that, with that many berries, you wipe them out. So, you know, when you start bringing in a species and putting it in an area where it has not evolved, something's going to change.
Right.
You know, and we saw that in China. My daughter lives over in China. We went to a sacred island out in East China Sea, and their invasive species are goldenrod. There, it's outlawed. You can't bring our native goldenrod. Which is one of our native plants.
Huh, isn't that interesting?
So,
multiflora rose. I don't see that much anymore.
Oh, I keep removing it off our property. It's when I see leaf in the woods now, and it has that arching habit, chances are it's the multiflora rose.
Okay.
And we already talked about it. I mean, Mark, when things start, the non-native species start flushing out earlier. And so I see it. I don't see it in people's yards so much because it is so aggressive. But it's a white flowering rose, small white flowers, cluster white flowers, crazy thorns on it. And it colonizes, but it does produce small little red, orange-red rose hips. The birds do like that. They'll drop it off. So that was a great pastor rose at one time. I mean, they would line their pastors with this rose that was from Japan, and they would line their pastors with that and kept
to make a fence.
To make a fence. Okay. Yeah.
Wow. We do have native roses.
Oh, beautiful native roses. Yeah. They are better for the birds, in fact. And, you know, some of these rose hips for the Carolina rose, for instance, that's a pink rose. If you see a rose in the woods and it's pink, chances are it is native.
Okay.
We've got several different species that occurs in around Nashville. They're going to be highly fragrant, gold eye to the center with pink, and a great pollinator plant. And then the birds, the rose hips, they're about the size of a dime, and the birds go crazy over them, and they're much better for the birds because of the vitamin C.
So wisteria is something that is grown quite a bit around, and the landscape architects continue to spec it for use in ornamental gardens and this sort of thing, to grow in arbors and this. Tell us about that.
Well, it's interesting, you know, you're talking about the landscape architects. You take a landscape architect from Atlanta and you probably won't see that, because they some of these states down below us have already outlawed that plant. And we're talking about the Wisteria floribunda or chinensis, that is the Chinese wisteria.
Okay.
And you can go drive down I-75 into north of Atlanta,
Georgia,
and look at those beautiful Georgia pines, we call them, covered in wisteria, bringing those trees down. So we know how invasive and aggressive, and to structures. I would never put one up on a pagoda or a gazebo. But there are native wisterias, and they're much more forgiving. They've been here for thousands of years. Yes, they are still that lavender blue bloom, and it has a fragrance. They still can grow up on a structure, but, you know, a fraction of the size of what these non-native species
would be. Yeah, we have one of those in an arbor in the back here, and it grows fairly aggressively, but not like the
Chinese, yeah.
Right. What else have we missed? Some of the periwinkle and those sorts of ground covers.
Yeah,
on the list of invasives?
They are on the list. You're going to see many species on our list, and we've got several different levels, some at a higher level. One that has been really new for us in the past couple of years has been the Kogon grass. It is a Japanese grass. And, you know, again, in the garden center, in the retail business, I sold a blood grass, is what the common name was, called Red Baron. And it was absolutely beautiful. It got up to about 18 inches tall max and had that beautiful blood red color in the summer going on into the fall. Drought tolerant, tough as nails. Well, we're finding it now, especially over in West Tennessee, and it's coming up. And what we're really noticing is these fear we have with this grass is the burn, the fire. And so when we start seeing it coming into the soybean fields and we start seeing it coming around the farms, is that, it takes a matchstick and it's done.
Wow.
It can burn up, you know, so it has so much fuel in it. And again, it's monoculture. So that's one. I think what IPSI, the Invasive Plant Council, really what we're trying to do now is that, okay, we can't do anything to prevent bush honeysuckle. We can't do anything to prevent the tree of heaven. Let's now concentrate a little bit more on prevention. So when we start to see a new invasive species or plant that may be, maybe it was just it's threatening the natural areas and now we're seeing more of it. Okay, there goes the red light, you know, and do something about it. And hopefully in the near future, there will be a new stop and grow list.
Right.
Okay. And a lot of my friends that are in the nursery business are a little worried about that too, Mark, because some of those may be some of their ornamental plants. You know, burning bush, I can't imagine too many neighborhoods around Nashville that doesn't have burning bush in it.
Right.
Now, what if that was all, you couldn't go to a garden center and buy burning bush or Nandina or the Bradford pear?
Right.
You know, so Yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, it's going to take all of us. It's going to take all of us to stem the tide, so to speak. And, you know,
and I will tell you, I was not at all persuaded that the Nandina was invasive, or the burning bush, because I've just, you know, I've been in a lot of parks and a lot of in Tennessee, and I had not seen it, but I have now.
Yeah. All of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether there's some warming that's happened, if these are things that, you know, like I said, the Nandina, invasive Nandina that we've seen now is just south of Chattanooga, how bad it is, and it's you know, is it coming our way? Well, yeah, more likely.
As things
the Cogon grass is coming up out of Mississippi into West Tennessee. So, yeah, we're seeing some things, and if you want to call it, you know, the warming that we're, whether we're having it or not, but there is some things happening. It's migrating north.
So, Mike, you know, you and I were talking before we got on the air here, and about the oak tree and the studies that have been done about that it is that particular species is host for more.
And that's been the greatest.
Tell
thing.
Us about.
Oh man, I love you know me, Mark. I love my oaks. I just well, okay. So bringing nature home.
You here
know
you
the
go.
Book. Dr. Doug Talaby, right. And he's been here at the National. In fact, the Garden Club brought him in one right. time to give a talk, and he's an entomologist. He's a bug man out of University of Delaware, and he put out this book that I have to say, of all the latest literature in the past couple of decades, this has been the one to turn the gardener's head better, more. And Bringing Nature Home, Dr. Doug Talaby, and he talks about our landscapes, our suburban landscapes, from a bug's point of view. Well, so what? You know, and I mean, you know, and he has some pretty close-up photos in his book.
You mean we need to be growing gardens for the bugs?
Well, okay, so what he says, and I think this is great, if you notice, you put your bird seed feeders out. Have you ever seen a bluebird go up to it?
Never have.
Or you know, a scarlet tanager, or, you know, there's so many species of birds. He's saying around 86% of our indigenous birds are carnivorous. They eat meat. Well, where is that meat? Unless you're hanging something up in that bird feeder that is meat, you know. They have to have worms or larvae or caterpillars, okay? Oaks, the Quercus genus, produces more food in larvae. It's the host for that many, 560, I believe it is. And that's all this meat of in the larva stage that these birds go to. Now, even the seed eaters, the vegetarians like goldfinch and cardinals, they still feed their young meat.
Yeah, they can't feed a baby bird a seed.
Right, so it's now he did have a list of several different plants there. And in this order, it was the oaks, it was the prunus, which is cherries and plums. So if you've got a plum tree, that can provide the food as well. And then willows. You know, so if you have a non-native weeping willow, that's still providing a lot of the food in the meat form. So, but it's the oaks. And like I said earlier, you know, if we have 24 species of oak, you can go up to Minnesota and count on one hand the species that occurs up there, you know. So I think that's what, again, that's great, is that that's put more oaks out there. That we are in here in Green Hills, where I'm sitting right now, there was probably 6 to 7 species of oaks that occurred here. In fact, you had one of the oldest chicken pen oaks I've ever seen in my life. It was here in this yard.
We had a beautiful tree that was struck by lightning and had to take it down.
It was a monster. How many years? How old?
It was a couple hundred years old.
A couple hundred years old.
Yeah, so. It was encroaching into the front porch. we were afraid that once it got damaged that we were going to have some trouble. But so we can have. We can really encourage a lot of wildlife in our yards, particularly birds.
Right.
If we're going to try to find a replacement for the burning bush,
that's a hard one. You know what? You know, that's what's been fun here lately is to go out to the woods in the fall and look back, you know, a couple hundred yards, and when all our leaves have dropped off, the burning bush is still there in the woods, and that distinct red, it stands out like no other.
We do have a native euonymus bush.
There is a euonymus, and that's what the burning bush is, euonymus elatus, right. And there is a euonymus americana, and there is, which is a strawberry bush or the hearts of Buston.
Hearts of Buston.
And I have seen some forms of that actually in the woods that has that burning bush red, okay? And of course, the seed are better for the birds.
Right.
And then there's a small tree that I really love, and it has the greatest common name, Wahoo. W-A-H-O-O, Wahoo, and that's Euonymus atropurpureus. And it's a small tree that also has the hearts of busting type of fruit.
Okay, not familiar with that.
I think this is the thing is that, you know, these are probably plants here that did occur. Now, you've got hearts of busting in your backyard and some specimens. They're beautiful. Probably not too far away from that, there might have been a Wahoo growing. You're not going to see as many of the Wahoos as you see the hearts of busting in the woods.
So we have the season for hummingbirds coming up. So what do we do for hummingbirds?
Well, coral honeysuckle. It's hard. Right. You know, think about it. If we didn't have our sugar water out there in those feeders, what would they be going to a thousand years ago? It would be one of the first things blooming, a coral honeysuckle. Columbine. Watch columbine, our native columbine, Aquilegia canadensis, and put it in your shade garden with those upside down blooms, okay? And look at the spurs that stand up out of it, and up in the bulb of those spurs, there's nectar. The hummingbird will hover underneath that flower to feed up in there.
They like the tubular flowers.
They love the tubular flowers, and if it happens to be an orange red, you know, crossvine, there's some great selections of crossvine now that are really helps the hummingbirds because they'll bloom longer into the summer when, of course, the hummingbirds are around all summer.
Well, you know, I predict the hummingbirds coming by when the azaleas bloom.
Oh, you got some beautiful
because
azaleas.
They're following those azaleas from the south to the north.
Yeah.
So most of the azaleas that people see out on the landscape are Japanese varieties.
They're Asian, Korean azaleas. And if you see an azalea blooming and it's evergreen, chances are it's not native.
Right.
Okay. So in the native world, on the North American continent, we have rhododendron. Well, if you took rhododendron, that genus, and all the leaves dropped off of it and became deciduous, then it became not a rhododendron anymore. It became a native azalea. And the native azaleas are hot. I did some work on those a few years back. There are more species of native azaleas in the southeast below the Mason-Dixon line than anywhere else in the world. And sure, there's some other deciduous azaleas out in the world, but this is a concentration. And if you don't believe that, just watch the Masters in March.
In the Masters, are those natives?
Those are mostly all native, yeah. So
wow.
You'll see the Florida flame azalea, you see the Piedmont azalea, you'll see the flamium, which is one of the craziest, prettiest native azaleas. And what's crazy about this, I just mentioned Florida flame, is that a lot of these native azaleas are coming up out of the south that did do great for us here in the winter. But I believe you have a Florida flame in your backyard.
I do.
When it's in bloom, is it fragrant?
Oh, it is killer. Just kill
them. You know,
yeah.
And I love using
those.
They don't
bloom for long now.
No,
a week or two.
And the idea is to put several different ones in so you've got succession. You know, native azaleas, according to the species, you can have some blooming up at the end of July going into the first of August.
We've had that. We have some of the flame azaleas.
Right. Azaleas. So you can have the early ones. Some of the Piedmont azaleas will start coming into bloom soon. The Florida flame will be coming into bloom soon. We're talking mid-March right now. And then you'll get some of these that go right on into the summer.
So you can have a lot of fun and a lot of show with the native plants.
Oh, well, you already know because you and Beth have had those for...
Well, I'm just saying. Now, speaking of which, we're going to wind things up here in just a second. Now, Mike, you have each spring at your facility in Fairview, you have a native plant festival.
It's a native plant festival. Back in about 21, we've been in business 21 years, and about 20 years ago, Terry and I, which she is my partner in all parts of my life.
All right.
She's the president of the company, and I'm the vice president. And she and I said, okay, let's have where everybody can just come in, and we'll call it our open house, because we were living there in our office, in fact. And said, so, well, just welcome everybody. So, and it was kind of an introduction to not only Grow Well, but what these native plants were. Well, as you know, it just evolved into this Native Plant Festival, and it's just been absolutely fun. We do it on the last weekend proper of April, and this year it'll be April 27th and 28th from 8 to 5. You do not have to make an appointment, which you will have to do the rest of the year, but during those 2 days, just show up. We have live music. We'll have, weather permitting, we'll have a mule ride for people that can ride down on this wagon down through our halls and back. We're going to have a wrought iron sculptor there showing her doing demos. We're going to have a mushroom guy there showing how to do mushrooms. And we're going to have on Saturday a bird walk. Last year we did a bird walk and they counted 62 or 63 species of birds.
Wow.
So, you know, the whole adage of you build it, they will come. So with all those native plants.
You have a big prairie out there.
We have a working green roof over one of our, you know, it's just all things native. We have a 27 kilowatt solar array set up there. So it's really, and we, you know, I've got the greatest crew in the world, and they know that week prior that we do everything we can to spiff up, wax the mulch, we sort of speak. And but you'll come in and see the native azaleas in bloom. You'll see wildflowers in bloom. And one of the big things we love doing on Saturday, we'll have Dr. Dwayne Estes come in and lead a wildflower walk. And what's cool is that you walk down through this 2 mile walk and you see these beautiful phlox in bloom and all these crazy things going on. You come up to the nursery, wow, there they are. You know, so you start to realize that trilliums, things like trilliums, are not that hard to have. And they used to be here, Mark, in your backyard. There were trillions growing here. So,
exactly.
You know, so we love the Native Plant Festival. It's one time where we get to really kind of brag about what we have there. People have a good time. You know, you've been there.
I've been there many times, and we're planning to go this year. We've had some difficulty with rain over the last couple of years.
Well, not too long ago, on May 1st, 2010, we woke up to the second day of our festival with rain. Not a problem, because when it rains, gardeners are crazy, Mark.
Yeah.
They'll come out in the rain.
Right.
Well, up about mid-morning, it's still raining. Around noon, it's still raining. And we're hearing reports of flooding down below. We're up on a ridge there at Fairview, and that was the historic flood of Nashville of 2010.
Right.
That Saturday.
Right.
So, the show will go on.
Exactly.
Rain or shine.
Exactly.
And the 10% off on all our plants, that's of course an extra incentive. I will tell you, though, get there early. And at 8 o'clock, there will be a line at the gate, you know, because we are a grower. We're growing. And you'll see plants that are coming along right next to plants that are now for sale. Well, of course, you want to get those plants that are 6 foot out of a pot or whatever, so get there early and grab those. And so with that said, Friday seems to be becoming more important than Saturday.
What do you mean Friday? Oh, in terms of Friday, being out there.
The availability on the plants.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. We could go on and on and on.
Oh, we could.
Certainly. But thank you, and thank you to the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council for sending you our way. And folks, check out his website, growwild.com, and also check out the Tennessee Invasive Plant Council's website.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Mark.